John Ronson is a writer and documentary filmmaker. His latest book is The Men Who Stare at Goats. In 1979, a secret unit was established by the most gifted minds within the U.S. Army to find all known accepted military practice and the laws of physics. They believed that a soldier could adopt a cloak of invisibility, pass cleanly through walls, and perhaps most chillingly, kill goats just by staring at them. Entrusted with defending America from all known adversaries, they were the 1st Earth Battalion, and they really weren't joking. What's more, they're back and fighting the war on terror. With firsthand access to the leading players in the story, John Ronson has traced the evolution of these bizarre activities over the past 3 decades, showing how they are alive now within the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and in post-war Iraq. Fascinating story. Our guest, John Ronson. Hi, John. How are you? Hi. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Hi, George. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. You know what? I was right as I was getting into your book, just by staring at the cover and, of course, the headline, The Men Who Stare at Goats, I looked at that and went, what is this all about?
Right.
Tell me about the cover in the headline of this book.
Okay, well, the cover, I mean, the cover, I suppose, is slightly factually wrong, because the cover is a goat with a whole lot of guns pointing at it. Now, at no stage, I think, did they actually point guns at goats, because what they did do, and this was at Fort Bragg in North Carolina, was that they had 30 goats in a place called Goat Lab. Now, the goats were there anyway. They were there for kind of traditional special forces training programs, that they'd throw a hand grenade into a room full of goats, and then they'd rush in and nurse the goats back to health. This was Goat Lab. Goat Lab used to be called Dog Lab, but then they decided that they really didn't want to do that stuff to dogs, so they switched to goats. So they had all these goats on base anyway, and in the early 1980s, they decided, we've got all these goats, let's see if we can try and kill them just by staring at them. So they set off on a mission to try and find a man who could stare a goat to death. And they found him.
Well, they did find him.
Well, possibly, anyway. I mean, it's kind of inconclusive whether he managed to actually kill a goat just by staring at it. But they found a man called Guy Savelli, who now runs a dance and martial arts studio in Ohio. And I found Guy as well. And they flew Guy in. Now, at one point, they had Guy in one room, and then they had all these goats, 30 goats, in another room, and Guy had them put numbers on each of the goats, 1 to 30, and Guy was staring at goat number 16, and apparently goat number 17 fell over. So I guess that's collateral damage. I'm sorry, George.
This is a bizarre story, John.
Yeah. I wouldn't have believed it myself if I hadn't chanced upon it. That isn't the only goat staring experiment that they did. They had them staring directly at goats. I mean, I obviously thought if they were, you know, throwing hand grenades in and operating on them, then maybe the goats were in a kind of shaky medical condition to begin with, and, you know, they just fell over because of that. But it turns out, no, it turns out that they always used healthy goats.
So was the plan to create some people who, let's say, could go to some function, and let's say the then Soviet head of the Politburo was there, and you'd sit back and stare at him and hope that he'd keel over and die? Was that what they wanted to do?
Well, I'm sure that some of the people involved had that in mind, but one of the main guys, General Stubblebine, who was the first person who flew to Fort Bragg and suggested that they tried to kill goats just by staring at them, he says, no, it's just like, it's kind of like remote, well, it's what they call remote influencing, isn't it? It's like one stage on from remote viewing. And his basic idea was, if you could do that with your mind, what else could you do? And General Stubblebine's philosophy, which I think is a very good philosophy, is that the U.S. Army has a debt to trying out this stuff, because if they don't try this stuff out, who would? And you know, the U.S. military does have a glorious history of trying out crazy madcap things, some of which work. The high visibility jacket probably wouldn't exist if it wasn't for the U.S. military. So, you know, so it came from a honorable place, and also a good-hearted place. This all sprung from the post-Vietnam funk. You know, I think it wasn't just individual soldiers who were suffering from post-combat depression. I think the entire military as a machine was traumatized in the years after Vietnam. And it was in this funk that they began looking to these new age human potential ideas, with the basic philosophy that if the American soldier could learn how to do this stuff, you know, walk through their walls and become invisible and kill things just by staring at them, nobody's going to want to screw around with an army that can do that. And so that's where they try. You know, a superpower needs superpowers.
Absolutely.
So that's where they tried to do all this stuff. That's how it all began.
How successful were they in trying to walk through walls or to become invisible, for crying out loud?
I think walking through walls was really unsuccessful. General Stubblebine spent, some time as commander of military intelligence. In the early 1980s, he had 16,000 soldiers under his command and an office in Arlington, Virginia. And he spent, you know, he spent quite a lot of time, you know, standing up from behind his desk, thinking to himself, what is the atom mostly made up of? Space. What am I mostly made up of? Atoms. All I need to do is merge the
spaces.
So he'd step out from behind his desk. I mean, to me, by the way, George, the key word in this is mostly, that the atom is made up mostly of space. It's not entirely made up of space. But anyway.
John, did he have a staff of physicists working with him, or was he just concocting these things by himself?
Well, that one in particular seemed to be basically his own idea, but it was inspired by a manual called the First Earth Battalion Manual, which I think we should talk about in a bit. He was a kind of lone in the wall walking, in his wall walking. He was kind of a lone wolf. Although I believe that other soldiers also tried to walk through their walls. But he would get out from behind his desk and he would, you know, walk towards the wall, and he'd be thinking, you know, all I need to do is merge the spaces. What is destiny? Am I destined to stay in this room? Of course I'm not. And then he'd bumped his nose on.
And bang, he'd break his nose or something like that.
Yeah, well, he that was one of his worries, actually, was if he continued to fail to walk through his wall, you know, would there be bruising on his nose? But luckily, and, you know, would people in his office spot this? But luckily, he was going through a messy divorce at the time, and he said to me that, you know, maybe if he turned up all bruised, people would think it was just domestic abuse. Because no one would think, well, what else could it be?
John, is he still alive?
Oh yes. I met him. I met him twice and had phone conversations with him as well.
Still in the military, or is he retired?
No. He was kind of forced into early retirement in 1983. I think he left the military, but he was very high up. He was a much respected 2-star general in charge of Army intelligence. At Arlington, so all of the signals intelligence, satellite technology, intelligence technology, he would have been in charge of prisoner of war intelligence, but there were no prisoners of war in the early 1980s. And the reason why he was forced into, or a reason why he was forced into early retirement, was because General Wickham, who was the chief of staff of the Army at the time, was quite a serious Christian. And he came to believe that some of General Stubblebine's ideas, like, you know, spoon bending and so on, and wall walking, if he'd known about
it. Too demonic, I guess, huh?
Yeah, it was the work of Satan. And that, which to me, you know, as a kind of secular guy living in London, sounds kind of just as nuts.
Well, were they really successful with any of these experiments?
Well, we know that there's some proven success with remote viewing.
Right.
And obviously MKUltra had a great deal of success, if you can call it success. Invisibility, what it seemed to do, some of the philosophy behind this was take, and this was all the brainchild of a lieutenant colonel called Jim Channon, by the way, and Jim's idea was, you know, if you could get a soldier to reach for the impossible, maybe that soldier could find something possible along the way. And some specific successes of this endeavor, this First Earth Battalion endeavor, includes a lot of non-lethal weapons that are used today, sound technologies like they're using in Iraq, you know, blasting prisoners with Barney the Purple Dinosaur, the sticky foam and all of that kind of stuff. That all came from Jim's philosophy that the soldier should be all that he can be. And in fact, the army slogan, be all that you can be, came from a fan of the 1st Earth Battalion, who, you know, who thought being all you can be includes walking through walls and so on.
This is just incredible that we would be concentrating on this to do these kinds of things. Now, of course, I've always been aware of the remote viewing program that the military had undertook, but I did not know that they wanted to walk through walls, make goats die by thinking of it. And by the way, you know, not that any animal is more important than the other, but why didn't they concentrate on mice?
Well, apparently it turns out that they've gotten some psychologist at Special Forces. This is when they were doing the conventional, you know, throwing the hand grenades into rooms full of animals. And they were doing all of this to dogs. And it was just really upsetting the soldiers. And in fact, I found something on a news group when I was writing this book when the soldier was saying it was awful. You know, we had to go in and, you know, break dogs' legs and then nurse them back to health. And everybody was, like, really upset. We just didn't want to do all this to dogs. And so some psychologist within Special Forces determined that it was almost impossible to form an emotional bond with a goat. So that's why Dog Lab became Goat Lab. And that's why they started staying at goats, because they had goats on base anyway. They're still ordering goats, by the way. They've just ordered another 1,000 goats or 600 goats.
What do you mean? Are they still doing this?
Well, what I know for certain is that the new chief of staff of the army, General Pete Shoemaker, is a big fan of Jim Channon's, and who's the guy who really invented all of this and has brought him back from retirement. And Jim's been meeting with majors and colonels and so on. And, you know, I can't help thinking that it's not a coincidence that Pete Shoemaker... Well, that Pete Shoemaker...
Believe in coincidences, by the way, John.
Right. Well, you see, I kind of do, but I think this isn't one. Is that the Pentagon... I know that General Shoemaker wasn't the Pentagon's first choice for the new chief of staff, but the fact that they asked this guy... who is a really big fan of the human potential movement, the New Age movement, Jim Channon. They asked him, you know, Rumsfeld asked him to be chief of staff of the army and has asked for creative input into the war on terror. And Pete Shoemaker has brought Jim Channon back from retirement. And we know that the remote viewers were called after 9/11. So it certainly seems to me that these paranormal endeavors, because they always come back in times of crisis. You know, in the first bunch of these kind of extreme out-of-the-box ideas began with MK Ultra during the Cold War. I mean, MK Ultra was a response to the paranoia of the Cold War, Sidney Gottlieb and so on. And then it all came back in the sort of post-Vietnam funk with Jim Channon and the 1st Earth Battalion, where people just weren't joining the military. I mean, it was a really bad time for the military. And that's when all these New Age ideas... And now we're in the third great crisis, aren't we?
Yeah, we sure are.
You know, you can look to history and you can look at the facts that are out there and you can guess that the paranormal stuff...
Did they try to experiment on anybody to try to kill them by staring at them or using, you know, mind manipulation or anything like that?
Well... I never heard of specific stories of that, but, you know that, I mean, as General Stubblebine said to me quite seriously, you know, if you can do this to a goat, you can do it to a person. So it's obvious that they had this stuff in mind. But what they clearly are doing in Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib and so on are these sort of warped, perverted versions of these hippie ideals that made their way into the military in the late 70s, early 1980s. I mean, if you stick a prisoner in a room and blast him with the I Love You song by Barney the Purple Dinosaur for 24 hours straight while flashing a strobe light at it.
Raising some kids, I want that. I think that's what they did to me for a while.
Right. Luckily, my son was always too wise for Barney, so I didn't succumb to that myself. But Jim Channon, the 1st Earth Battalion manual that floated through the military in the late 1970s with all these ideas, soldiers should try and walk through walls, everything from that to soldiers should carry baby lambs into hostile countries and place the lambs on the ground and give the enemy a hug. These were some more of Jim Channon's ideas. He was also advocating quite heavily in the 1st Earth Battalion manual the use of sound technologies, high and low frequency sounds, blasting people with silent sounds and discordant music. And when I started doing all of that in Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib, and I've met Guantanamo detainees who told me that they were, put into a room and blasted with an all-girl Fleetwood Mac covers band.
That's not all bad if you like Fleetwood Mac.
Well, yeah, although what seemed kind of weird with that particular bit of musical torture was that unlike Barney and, I don't know, Springsteen and Metallica, this was played at normal volume to this guy, Jamal Al-Harris. He was put in Guantanamo. They put him in a room, and they played in Fleetwood Mac at normal volume. The conspiracy theorist in me thinks, why would they do that? And I said to Jamal, was it entertainment? And Jamal said, certainly not. We suspect they might have been lacing these CDs with, high and low frequency sounds.
Well, what was the outcome after they played this music to these people?
Well, Jamal said it didn't really do anything at all to him. But the military does have a history of trying out stuff that doesn't work. Maybe they stuck subliminal sounds in there and it just didn't do anything. Subliminal sounds always sound so kind of mysterious, but it's really just a psyop soldier at Fort Bragg.
I just can't believe
into a microphone, confess.
We pay all this money in taxes, John, and they're using Barney the Dinosaur songs to torture people mentally.
You know what I think about Barney? Now, by the way, but the original point that I was coming to with all of this was that all of that was contained in Jim Channon's manual too. And I said to General Stubblebine and to Jim Channon, is this the 1st Earth Battalion musical torture? Is this your idea alive today? And they both said, yeah.
How did you find this? How did you find this out?
It began, really. I mean, it began with me sneaking into Bohemian Grove with Alex Jones.
Well, and we're going to talk with you and Alex next hour about that.
Yeah, seems so nuts. I mean, I won't talk about it now if we're talking about it then, but Bohemian Grove just seems so nuts that our leaders would want to spend their summer vacation throwing a papier-mâché effigy into the fiery belly of a giant stone owl.
It's just crazy. Stay with us. John Ronson, our guest. His website, of course, is linked up with coasttocoastam.com, but it's simple. I'll spell it. John, J-O-N. Ronson, R-O-N-S-O-N, just run them together, johnronson.com. We actually had people staring at goats trying to kill them. What a story. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour with guest John Ronson, we're going to talk about the Bohemian Grove. He infiltrated it. And then during the middle part of that hour, we're going to bring in Alex Jones. He, too, infiltrated the Bohemian Grove as well. We'll get his take on some of these strange things that continue to go on our planet. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Our guest is John Ronson right here on Coast to Coast AM. John, you're also a best-selling author. Your book, Them, Adventures with Extremists. How did you get involved in this very strange type of research that you've been doing?
There was a guy living up the road from me called Sheikh Omar Bakri Mohammed, who's Britain's most notorious Islamic cleric. Well, they just kicked him out, actually, called the 9/11 hijackers.
Okay, that was him. Same one. Okay.
Yeah, same guy. And I spent a year with Omar Bakri back in 97, filming a documentary about his life. Really, I just thought it was funny. I mean, at the time, don't now. But at the time, I thought it was funny that here was a guy living among us who said he wanted to see the black flag of Islam flying over Downing Street. So I figured, you know, he lives down the road from me. He's going to need to use our symbols to destroy them. So I followed him around for years. He was buying, you know, collection boxes for Hamas, and the only collection boxes they had were large plastic novelty Coca-Cola bottles and so on. And it was kind of like a carry-on movie, Omar's Jihad campaign.
Did he know you were following him?
Yeah. He didn't know I was Jewish. Although he outed me. He took me to his Jihad training camp, which was near Gatwick Airport in a little scout hut. And he suddenly announced to the crowd, look at me with an infidel. Look at me with John, who is a Jew. And they all went, in the middle of nowhere, which is not the best place to be outed as a Jew. But when I was with all these people, they all started telling me, did you know that there was a shadowy cabal secretly ruling the world from inside a secret room? And I said no. And I didn't really think about it. And then I made a documentary about the Klan in the Ozarks. This was the politically correct Klan run by a guy called Tom Robb, who wouldn't let his members use the N-word. And he kind of banned the robes and the hoods and, you know, the cross burnings. He kind of banned all the things that I guess were fun about being in the Ku Klux Klan. But his people all started saying the same thing. Did you know that there was a shadowy cabal ruling the world? So it suddenly dawned on me, you know, I bet none of these guys actually, you know, get on a plane and actually try and track down the shadowy cabal. There really is a secret room. Can you get in there? So I wrote this book then, Adventures with Extremists, in which I tried to find the secret room. And I got chased away by the Bilderbergers in Portugal.
And tell me, who are, in your mind, the Bilderbergers? Because we hear so much about that organization, of course, meeting at the Bilderberg Hotel, right?
Well, that's where they first met. We followed them to the Caesar Park Hotel in Sintra, Portugal, me and a guy called Big Jim Tucker from the American Free Press. It was the spotlight at the time. And we scouted around the hotel, pretending to be traveling salesmen. This was the day before these guys were supposed to arrive, who, by the way, I didn't believe existed at the time. I thought this was all, you know, this was just a paranoid fantasy. And as we left the hotel, we started getting followed by men in dark glasses, which completely terrified me. I mean, just totally freaked me out. I phoned at the British Embassy and explained to them that I was essentially a humorous journalist out of my depth. They phoned the Bilderbergers. And so the British Embassy called me back and said that the Bilderbergers said that nobody was following me. And I'm saying, you know, he's behind the tree. And so, you know, so suddenly I was really thrown into the deep end, being chased by shadowy henchmen in dark glasses.
Did you think they were going to do you in, John?
Yeah, I really handled it badly. Jim Tucker was loving it. You know, he was sort of blowing them kisses. And I was going, Jim, stop that. And I got very, you know, I got paranoid for a long time. You know, I was thinking that they were following me even when they weren't. Eventually I got to meet some of the heads of the Bilderberg group, including Martin Taylor, who's the Secretary General, who's the CEO or has been the CEO of Barclays Bank and W.H. Smith.
So. They're all wealthy people, aren't they, John?
Yeah, they're sort of wealthy centrists, mainly kind of centrist globalists. When I said to Dennis Healy, Lord Healy, who was one of the founding members, you know, is it fair to say that you were trying to create a world government? He sort of said, yeah, that's fair.
You're very nonchalant, right? Just boom, just spit it right out like that?
Yeah. Which surprised me, actually, because, of course, that's something that anti-Bilderbergers have always accused the Bilderberg of, you know, trying to create a one-world government. And Dennis Healy said, yep, that's true. He said that, you know, post-Second World War, we needed to find a way to, you know, thwart future Hitlers. And the idea would be to take politics out of the hands of politicians and put it into the hands of, you know, industrialists and bankers. Take ideology out of politics. That seems to be the Bilderberg agenda.
Did he talk, John, and it sounds like he was pretty free with you.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
Not that free. At one point I asked if, he's a very keen photographer, Lord Healy. I asked if I could see his photographs he took inside Bilderberg, and he told me to F off. So he wouldn't do that. But he was basically free, wasn't he?
Did he ever say that they have the ability to control presidents, prime ministers, other people throughout this planet who are running governments?
What they did say to me was that there are times when a Bilderberg meeting will have impacts on world affairs. And they gave me a couple of examples. One was Margaret Thatcher was kind of talent spotted by Bilderberg in the mid-70s. And apparently she did really badly. Sat at the back like a church mouse. And then somebody told her to buck up. And so she gave a fantastic speech, apparently. And everybody was so impressed that they flew her over to America, and David Rockefeller drove around in a limousine and, you know, introduced her to all these important people. And the person, the Bilderberg who told me that, said, you know, well, is that a conspiracy, or is that just the way things are done? And there were things like that. Sanctions against the Falkland Islands during the Falklands War, apparently, was an idea that began at Bilderberg and sort of spread back into the various different foreign policy departments of different countries.
So they have the ear, though, of leaders, don't they?
Oh, yes, goodness. I mean, no question. What I said, obviously Jim Tucker would say that they make Clinton president, they make Blair prime minister. The Bilderbergers say, no, they're just really good talent spotters. What they want to do is get the person they think might be the next prime minister into a room with them, and they can offer them wise words.
Very wise, like you will help us. How many Bilderberger members are there?
There's different stratas, because there's the steering committee, and I think it's two from each country. So two Brits, two Americans, two Germans, and so on. And then they will get together and decide who to invite each year. And then there's the outer strata, which is like a kind of, you know, the people who just come in for that one meeting. And so the year I was chased away, you had the head of Monsanto there. You had Jonathan Porritt from Friends of the Earth. And I don't think those people, just the fact that they attended a Bilderberg meeting, doesn't make them Bilderbergers. So I think you need to...
No, that's true.
You need to differentiate. Right. But the steering committee is, you know, people like Kissinger, Rockefeller, Conrad Black, you know, head of newspapers all over the world, was a big Bilderberger.
Is it possible that there were other members of this organization that were even above these people? You just never saw them?
We watched them all going in limousine. Well, taxis, actually, dusty taxis they all turned up in. No, I think that the guest list that they do send out as a press release is who is there attending the meetings. It's a powerful think tank from the kind of liberal center-left, you know, with the exception of people like Rockefeller and Kissinger.
Why, though, in conspiracy theory, do people think of this organization, and of course it's the Illuminati also, why do people think of them as people who want to get the population down to 500 million worldwide from 6 billion? They want to take over wars. They're involved in terrorism. They have their own agenda. Why do people believe that about these people?
Well, they certainly have their own agenda, and their agenda is quite often at great odds to a lot
humanity,
of people.
Probably.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a nationalist, then you know you're no friend of the Bilderbergers. There's no question about that. If you don't believe in globalization or one world government, you know the Bilderbergers are out to turn you into a twig in the tidal wave. If you believe that politics should be ideological and not run by business, then you are an enemy of the Bilderbergers. Now, there's other stuff like, you know, population control. I know people have said that about Bilderberg. I have no idea whether it's true. I've got no idea whether...
No information on that, really.
Yeah, I mean, I was sent the minutes of the Bilderberg meeting that I was chased away from, and it was kind of boring, the minutes, I hate to say. It was all, you know, it was a globalist think tank. You know, they've denied existing from time to time. They're very secretive.
Although do you find them to be dangerous people, John?
Well, I was, you know, when they were chasing me around Portugal, I was pretty freaked out.
Absolutely, so sure.
You know, I was scared then. I wouldn't want to get on the wrong side of them, but I don't believe that.
Well, let me rephrase it. Do you think they have the betterment of mankind in mind?
I think that's in the eye of the beholder. I mean, do you think it's a good idea to, you know, to take power away from politicians and put it into the hands of the head of Nokia and Heinz and SmithKline Beecham?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, I don't even think it's wise to give the politicians power. I think the people should have it.
Mm. Well, the people don't have power, right? We just don't.
We don't. We think we do, but we don't.
Yeah, we really, really don't. I mean, that really is, you know, life, sadly. I mean, you only have to look at, you know, the Iraqi war to see that there wasn't much we could do about that.
Do you think, though, that this organization, the one that you were part of and witnessed, mm-hmm. that they're the ones that steer everything on this planet?
No, I don't. I think that that members of the organization are, you know, very, very powerful people. And they certainly think, you know, this is the way things are done. This is life. This is the way, you know, we do things. David Rockefeller would think there is absolutely nothing wrong with talent spotting an up-and-coming president and offering him sensible words in the corridor at a Bilderberg meeting, because he would say that's not a conspiracy, that's the way things are done, that's life. People like that are certainly self-appointed rulers of the world.
Do they build people? Do they build presidents?
Well, bringing Margaret Thatcher over to the States and driving her around in limousines and introducing her to all the important
before she became the prime minister.
Yeah, before right. she became the prime minister. Is that building them? I suppose it is. I suppose it is in a way.
Sure.
Yeah.
Do we know if Bill Clinton ever?
Yeah, I believe Bill Clinton attended Bilderberg in I can't remember exactly when, but I believe Clinton did.
Before he was president. Yeah. And Blair before he was prime minister?
Yeah. I said to Martin Taylor, the head of the Bilderberg Group, you know, you're really good at spotting these people. And he said, thank you.
Sounds like they make them, John.
Well, that's the debate, right? They would say that they don't, but maybe they don't realize, because that's the way they live their lives day after day after day, they do pull the strings. Maybe they do pull the strings without consciously seeing themselves.
No, I don't know. I think they know. I think they're fully aware of their power and influence.
I try and, you know, I really, especially when you're dealing with this kind of stuff, Bilderberg, Bohemian Grove, you know, the men who stare at goats, you know, these weird paranormal activities in the military. I mean, this is really kind of hairy stuff that I write about and get myself into the middle of. And to keep my own sanity, I really try and work out in a pretty central, sort of moderate way what this is all about. I try and see the story from everyone's perspective, from the perspective of their enemies, of conspiracy theorists, from the perspective of kind of secular liberals like me, and from the perspective of the people involved in these weird events, you know, major generals and so on. I try and just sort of take the facts and work out what is the most rational explanation.
You have a fellow Brit out there by the name of David Icke. He's been on our program several times, John.
Yeah, David's in my book.
What do you think of David? Are you friends? Do you know him? What?
Yeah. Well, I followed him to Vancouver. You know, David believes that the Bilderbergers and the people at Bohemian Grove and so on are actually 12-foot lizards, you know, shape-shifting lizards.
Yes, reptilians.
Yeah. I followed David. I went with David to Vancouver, where this powerful coalition of anti-racist groups like the Anti-Defamation League and the Canadian Jewish Congress were all convinced that when David Icke said 12-foot lizards, he was using code. And what he really meant was Jews. And David Icke was saying, no, I really do mean lizards. To which they were saying, well, that's code too. And they got David stopped in Canada. He would turn up at these book readings to find that they'd been mysteriously cancelled and so on. And I think what that story tells us is, yes, it's kind of crazy that David believes the 12-foot lizards rule the world, but it's also equally crazy to believe he's using code for Jews and they must get him stopped at the airport and seized under hate crimes legislation and so on. And to me, that's a story of a kind of pressure cooker of paranoia on both sides, as people like David get crazier, so do the responses towards him. I'm kind of fond of David. I had a big email exchange with him a couple of days ago, in fact. And in fact, it was David Icke who I asked first if he'd come with me to Bohemian Grove when I decided that I wanted to sneak in. And David declined, saying that that's where they turn themselves back into giant lizards, which is why I ended up asking Alex Jones.
We'll find out if they did turn into lizards next hour when we chat about this.
Yeah. But you asked earlier how I came to find the goat staring and, all the stuff that I write about in the Manisteric Goats. And that was really because of Uri Geller.
Really? So, I like... Uri's been a great friend of this program. I like him a lot.
And I'm sorry that I called him Uri just then. It was terrible. Yeah. Slippage.
Well, he says Uri, doesn't he?
Yeah, he says Uri. Yeah. Always says Uri. I'm very fond of Uri. I knew him about 10 years ago when he announced that he was that he knew where the Lost Ark of the Covenant was buried and he was going to dig it up. So I phoned him up and I said, can I come? And we had a bunch of meetings back there, and it didn't really work out because he wanted me to organize the visas.
Did he ever go? I don't think he ever found that. What happened?
No, he never went. He never went. Oh, I think he thinks it's in Iraq or somewhere like that. He was going to drive there in his cutlery-covered limousine.
It might be. Some people believe it's in Ethiopia.
Yeah, yeah. Uri definitely knew where it was. But he never went to dig it up. But after 9/11, I had lunch with him, and I said I was thinking about doing a story about the military's involvement in the paranormal, and Uri turned up at this restaurant with big dark glasses and his brother-in-law, Shippy, and I said, so Uri, tell me about your time with the CIA, and Uri said, I'd never talk about it, which I thought was very strange, because, he kind of always talks about it. I said, Uri, what's going on?
What's wrong, yeah.
Yeah, so finally he took off his dark glasses and he said, if you repeat what I'm about to tell you, I will deny it. And I said, okay. And Uri said, this is no longer a history story. I have been reactivated. So I said, Uri, who's reactivated you? And he said, I will tell you only one thing. The man who reactivated me is called Ron. And that was it.
And
so
that
the
Manisteric
Goats began with a search for Ron. And I never found Ron, but I did find a lot of really weird stuff.
Let's talk about Bohemian Grove when we come back, John. I'm George Norrie with you, John Ronson, our guest. John, how did you get to infiltrate the Bohemian Grove in California?
Well, I kept hearing these, rumors about this place, Bohemian Grove, that this is where the Bushes and Kissinger go. And on the Saturday night, they dress up in robes and hoods and they throw a human effigy into the fiery belly of a giant stone owl. So I thought, well, that can't be true. Because my book, Them, was all about trying to sneak in to these elitist Illuminati-type cabals, I kind of figured I had to sneak into Bohemian Grove. And I met Alex Jones. I asked David Icke first, and he said he didn't want to come. I didn't want to go alone because, frankly, I was frightened.
Why didn't David want to go?
He once went to the perimeter of Bohemian Grove, but he just didn't want to go further. I don't know. But I'd met Alex when he rebuilt David Koresh's church at Waco. I visited David Koresh's church with Randy Weaver And that's where we met Alex. And Randy said he was a big fan of Alex's.
Randy Weaver from Ruby Ridge.
Yeah, from right? Ruby okay. Ridge. Because I wrote quite a lot about Ruby Ridge in them and hung around with the family, or what's left of the family.
Yes.
And Alex struck me as a very gung-ho man. And I sort of wanted company, sneaking into Bohemian Grove. So I phoned him up and we got talking, and Alex said, I'm going to come along too. I'll get a camera right up in their faces and we'll confront these devil-worshipping
I call Alex, by the way, the bulldog.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I said to Alex that I thought stealth might be a better approach when infiltrating Bohemian Grove. Alex said, okay, stealth. So we met up in the Occidental Lodge in Northern California. And our plan had been, basically, I think, to rent a boat and to sail it along the Russian River and climb up a mountain and kind of shimmy down the other side and get in that way. It was a kind of ill-conceived plan. But when we were there, we met this lawyer called Rick, who had himself infiltrated the Grove. And Rick said, no, if you go in that way, you're going to get yourself killed, not by the Grovers, but by the terrain. He said, what you do is you go to the local preppy clothes store, buy preppy clothes, and just walk up the drive, giving the security guard a kind of I rule the world wave. So that's what we did. We went to Eddie Bauer, and Alex went in, looking like a sort of Texan redneck, went into the dressing room and came out looking like the Great Gatsby, sort of in cashmere. I'm exaggerating slightly, but not that much. And then Alex and Mike, his producer, started practicing being preppy by having kind of preppy conversations about microprocessors in the corridor of our hotel. And then we split up. I think, Alex, you'll ask him when he comes on, but I've got a feeling about midway through that afternoon, it dawned on Alex that it was possible that I was part of the conspiracy and I was luring him into the Grove.
Really?
I don't know.
We'll ask him that. Okay. He'll shoot straight with us. Okay. I mean, do you two get along?
Yeah, well, I'm extremely fond of Alex. But anyway, Alex, we went in separately. I went in with Rick, the lawyer, up the drive. Alex and Mike went in via the undergrowth. But we all got in. And I met them, how in this weird camp. I mean, it's a strange place with all this kind of devilish iconography all over the place, little red devil eyes,
Well, don't you think it's strange, John, that here's a place that had some heavy hitters there, high-powered people, and four of you were able to kind of like infiltrate to get in? You would think they would have armed guards everywhere.
And apparently they did have armed guards in the days before we arrived. People from the village, Monte Rio, were telling us that the FBI were all over the place in the days before we turned up. And, we saw Dick Cheney's name on the guest list. We saw George Bush's name on the guest list, George Bush Senior. So, I'm sure those guys were there. We heard that John Major was there as well, ex-British Prime Minister. It surprises me a lot that we managed to get in so easily. Maybe, it's been years since anybody had tried to get in and they just weren't thinking about it.
How close did you get to the festivities?
Oh, we were right there in the middle of them. It was incredible, actually. We sort of made ourselves, we sort of blended into the background, wandering around this campsite, this incredible campsite with jacuzzis and grand pianos and, bars. I mean, this was a posh camp, a posh and weirdly devilish camp. It was all the little camps had names like Red Devils and things like that. Yeah. It was like a kind of Halloween movie.
Did it feel strange?
Well, at the time, that didn't feel strange because I kind of figured, okay, that's just the kind of milieu that they've decided to create for themselves. It's kind of immature. We saw all these photographs of these guys dressed in drag, with sort of garish lipstick. It seemed like a kind of grown-up fraternity at this point to me. Immature, slightly misogynistic, because these kind of grotesque parodies of women. And it did cross my mind, you know, I would not want to spend my summer vacation doing this stuff. You
know, but bizarre nonetheless, considering
who these people
were. Right.
Especially when you remember, you know, the caliber of people who go to Bohemian Grove.
Right.
I mean, you're talking, you know, at least it's, you know, big, important, powerful business people from, you know, from major cities in America, and at most it's presidents. And
what do you think their interest is, John, in these bizarre rituals were being done there?
Well, we went to the ritual at about 9 o'clock in the evening. The bell rang, and all these old men, all of whom looked like Mr. Burns and The Simpsons, all drifted down to this lawn, and there's about 1,000 of them. And on one side of the lawn with us, I mean, you know, me and Alex were, you know, by far the youngest people there. And then on the other side of this pond, there was the giant stone owl. And then this kind of pageant begins. And it begins very much as, you know, they've got the San Francisco Orchestra there, Philharmonic, I think, you know, playing this stuff, and you know, in the moonlight.
The whole orchestra or just a couple of guys?
Well, there's a big orchestra there. Apparently, the orchestra have to stay in crappy tents on the periphery. They don't get to stay in the Kissinger tent. And then this kind of guy appears in the trees, in the giant redwoods, dressed in kind of leaf-covered lederhosen. You know, like some kind of elfin Germanic Tarzan.
And what is he doing?
Well, he starts singing this eulogy to nature, like, oh, trees, oh, leaves, oh, boughs, whatever. All this is in my book, Them. And then you hear this kind of bomb, 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 and all these guys start appearing in the trees in these kind of red robes and hoods, kind of like posh Klansmen.
They're up in the trees?
No, but at this point, the elfin lederhosen guy seems to be in a sort of stage cut out of a giant redwood. But the other guys, the sort of 20 or 30 berobed gentlemen, came in on the ground through the trees and congregated in front of the owl. Alex filmed all of this in a hidden camera.
Yeah, I've seen his video on that. So
yeah.
Pretty
and,
remarkable stuff.
And then they have this, you know, bizarre ceremony, which culminates, sure enough, in a human effigy, the voice of Dol Caer saying, "Ye shall not burn me," and spits on the high priest, and this kind of firework, this kind of gob of fire, rains down from the trees and hits the high priest in his hat, which was both, you know, really impressive and also really, I thought, this kind of stupid.
And is the place kind of quiet other than the events that are going on? I mean, all these people, the thousands that are there, are they like hushed?
Yeah, well, and this is the thing, you know, that amazed me most of all looking back at Bohemian Grove. And this is where I really agree with Alex, you know. After we got out of the Grove, Alex released his film, Dark Secrets Inside Bohemian Grove, where he said it was occultic and it might be actual human sacrifice, and he kind of went around America telling people this. And then I released my book, Them, and I also put, you know, our film out on Channel 4 TV, and I went around Britain saying, oh, it's just immature, it's just stupid, it's you know. So, and you know, so we had very different interpretations of it. But one day I was in Belfast, actually, giving a talk, and I remember this very clearly. I was standing on stage and I was thinking, what am I doing standing here as a kind of self-appointed defender of the Bush's proclivity towards mock human sacrifice, you know? What am I doing saying, oh, it's nothing? I don't know that it's nothing. And the thing that I remember most of all was what Alex had said, which was that the people in the crowd, the people sitting among us, were really, really into it. You know, they were rubbing their hands and they were going, burn him, burn him. And this was really true. You know, the people in the crowd, at least the people in the crowd, were just as into the ritual as...
And I bet they were all multimillionaires.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I don't know if all of them were, but, you know, I mean, we know that Bohemian Grove attracts, you know, very wealthy, important, powerful people. I don't know if all 1,000... a wealthy, important people, but there's certainly a lot of them. And they were really into it. And I just thought, this is nuts. You know, our leaders, you know, strike me as nuts. You know, that they would want to spend their summer vacation having a mock human sacrifice, even if all it is that they're burning, you know, all their cares in the world. It's so kind of weird mix of, you know, paganism and Broadway.
I mean, do you think these people are Satanists, John?
No. And this is where me and Alex differ. And I know that Alex thinks that the First Earth Battalion and all the stuff I spoke about in the first hour, you know, with the Menesteric goats, is all to do with the occult and Satan. And I, you know, I don't believe that. Because I think if you start thinking that about our leaders, what you're forgetting, I mean, the conclusion I have come to, I've been doing this for like 7 or 8 years now, both with them and with the Menesteric goats. And the conclusion I've come to is that our leaders can be nuts and they can be fallible and their minds can take them. They get themselves, just like us, you know, they can get into this kind of bubble of irrational thought. And inside the bubble, it makes absolute sense to General Stubblebine that it's possible, you know, head of army intelligence, to walk through his wall. Or it makes absolute sense that you can kill a goat just by staring at it. So I don't believe this is like knowing a cultish, although, you know, Satanism. You know, I believe that it's this kind of bubble of nutty irrational thought that manifests itself not just on the fringes of society, but also at the heart of power.
Do you ever see the movie Eyes Wide Shut? That old
yeah,
movie?
I did. And, you know, I got friendly with a lot of Kubrick's people, his wife and his executive producer.
They were in red robes, too. Sounds a little like the Bohemian Grove.
Well, I sent Jan Harlan, the producer of Eyes Wide Shut, my Bohemian Grove film, because I always wondered, actually, whether Kubrick, you know, who was great at research, knew all about Bohemian Grove. And Jan was amazed by it. And said
he died before he finished that movie, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. But Jan said that Bohemian Grove, that they didn't know about Bohemian Grove when they made Eyes Wide Shut. They, you know, the first Jan had heard of Bohemian Grove was, you know, 2 years ago when I sent him my video.
What is your take then, John, overall of Bohemian Grove? Why they go, what they get out of this? I mean, for it to be a summertime party, that's a little strange.
Yeah, it's really intense. You know, the people there were like really into it, and it was very kind of, is it orgiastic or orgiastic, whatever, however you pronounce it. It was like that. It was, you know, all that kind of public urination, and you know, there was like a lot of sort of hyperventilating around the time that the papier-mâché effigy was thrown into this fire. It was kind of weird. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I don't believe that it was, you know, an occultist ritual. But what I do believe is that if it was people letting their hair down, they were letting their hair down in an extremely strange and intense way. And that was the question, really, that led me to write the Menesteric Goats. I mean, you know, why do they do this kind of thing?
The Men Who Stare at Goats. I still love that title.
Oh, it's a great title. By the way, that nowadays, going back briefly to the Menesteric Goats, Guy Savelli, you asked earlier if this stuff was alive again, and Guy Savelli told me, and I believe him, that he started going down to Fort Bragg again with an animal. And I said to him, is it a goat? And he said, no. And I said, what kind of animal is it? And he said, he wouldn't tell me. And I said, is it a cheap animal, easy to purchase? And he said, yes. And I said, is it a hamster? And he said, I can neither confirm nor deny that. So I assume
something like that
Guy has taken hamsters to Fort Bragg and Special Forces soldiers are now standing around staring at the hamster.
Well, something's going on.
So maybe I should have called it the Menesteric Hamsters.
Well, John, where does all this take you next?
You know, I don't know. I wish I did, because then I'd be writing another book.
They've left you alone, right? You haven't been followed by the Men in Black yet again?
Well, there's been a bit of trouble since the book.
Oh, really? Tell me. What happened?
Well, just a bit, really. I mean, some of the people in the book, decided to deny that they ever met me, some of the colonels and generals and so on. And they told some journalists that they hadn't met me.
Well, they didn't expect the book, or what happened?
Well, it began as a TV series. And in fact, it was broadcast as a TV series in the UK. And it was only about halfway through that I decided to write a book. And I think what probably happened was that they didn't, because they didn't expect a book to come out, they kind of thought maybe the John Ronson who wrote the book is a different John to the John who interviewed them for the TV series. But what certainly did happen was that a bunch of them said that they'd never met me. And I had to tell a whole bunch of journalists a few months ago, you know, really, I did meet them. And not only did I meet them, but I filmed my time with them. And I've got it all on film. So it kind of went away, and they're no longer saying it. But that
was pretty difficult to deny they ever met you when you got them on videotape.
Yeah, I kind of figured, you know, these are sort of military intelligence people, you know, high up. If they're going to try and discredit me, why discredit me with something that's so easy to refute? Because, you know, I've got 100 hours of footage of me hanging around with these guys. By the way, you know, something we never talked about, which I will if you'd like me to, is how all this came to be, all the goat staring and the paranormal stuff and the kind of sound weapons.
Yeah, we've got about a minute and a half before the break. Go ahead.
Okay, well, basically, it was because of Vietnam. Jim Channon, just a regular lieutenant colonel in Vietnam, realized that his men were being killed because they were guileless and kind-hearted and were firing high, missing the enemy. The Viet Cong were cunning sharpshooters, but the American soldier wasn't. And so after Vietnam, Jim asked the Pentagon if he could go on a fact-finding mission to teach the American soldier to be more cunning. And the Pentagon agreed, and they sent Jim to California. And Jim spent 2 years in the kind of Esalen-type, you know, New Age communities of California, learning all this, you know, burgeoning New Age human potential stuff, that it was possible to walk through walls and so on. And he put it all in a manual called the First Earth Battalion Manual. And after 2 years, he brought it back to the Army. And, you know, in this manual, soldiers would learn to be invisible. They'd learn to walk through walls. They'd learn to blast people with discordant music and so on. And the Pentagon was so taken with these ideas, they were kind of moved by these ideas, that they offered Jim the chance to set up an actual First Earth Battalion. And Jim said no. What he wanted to do was allow these ideas to just float out throughout the military. And wherever a soldier was inspired to try this stuff out, that person would be a member of the First Earth Battalion. And Jim's manual made it to Fort Bragg, and that's why they started staring at goats. And Jim's manual made it to Arlington, to Army Intelligence, which is why General Stubblebine started trying to walk through his wall. And I always thought that's a very interesting way. You know, this is how ideas form in the U.S. military.
All right, stay with us here, John. We've got to take this break, and then we'll... Alex Jones, an award-winning documentary filmmaker and political researcher. His news websites, Infowars.com, PrisonPlanet.com, always at the forefront of the very growing alternative media. Alex is recognized by many as the father of the 9/11 truth movement, being the first to question the official story. His newest film, Martial Law 9/11, Rise of the Police State, details his latest investigations into the 9/11 revelations. And what would be a discussion on Bohemian Grove, Alex, without having you at least a part of this for a moment? How are you?
George, I was really excited when I heard that John was coming on because he's just an amazing writer, and it really was his idea to sneak into Bohemian Grove. At the time, he was like, don't tell him I snuck in, just so I've always kept that confidence until now. He's talking about it. But it was amazing to go inside of the Grove and to witness all of this, and I went in there with an open mind. I mean, I told everybody, I don't know what we're going to find. I hope it's all rumors. I didn't want to believe that this was going on, you know, these eyes wide shut type activities, but It was Luciferian in nature. It was a mock human sacrifice, and now we've got the Skull and Bones video that ABC News got where they're doing mock human sacrifices, same group of people. These are our supposed Christian conservative leaders, predominantly, that go there, and they know exactly what they're doing, and this is an ancient Canaanite ritual that they have revived. It is the most accursed demon, Moloch, of the Old Testament. And you know, I'm glad that John talks about, you know, how he sort of thinking back and going, wait a minute, I mean, this is hidden in plain view. He may not totally agree with me, but I think over time you see that John is beginning to realize just how bizarre all of this is. But in the last 5 years, we have, you know, we have them now. And we have their own internal publications. Even the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times has written about them. I have a bunch of their own internal documents, which almost all of them include the owl eating children or stomping on bloody children. That is a artist rendering of that. This is truly, truly sick. And you know, John talks about his new book where the Pentagon was very receptive to all this, quote, New Age stuff. Well, a lot of the New Age is really the Old Age, and this is, you know, that's what black magic is it's actively going out and using it, you know, forcing your will. You know, that's the dark side in Star Wars, is forcing the force to your will, you know, forcing the universe to do what you want. And so it fits all the classical definitions of the occult, of black magic. And in my film, Dark Secrets Inside Bohemian Grove, we have the proof. We have the video of the Luciferian ritual. And so there's really no way to deny it. People need to go to Infowars.com or PrisonPlanet.com. We have much of the ritual, most of it for free, posted there on Infowars.com. CoastToCoastAM.com graciously has a link to it. Lex put a link to it. And listen, I wish this wasn't true. But it is real, and every time I investigate something, it tracks back to the occult. It tracks back not just to the occult, but to these workers in the darkness, these people that, you know, like forging the armies of Mordor. J.R.R. Tolkien talked about how a lot of what he did in his books, why they're so successful in archetypal fashion, is because it's based as archetypes on a lot of real things in history. You know, the all-seeing eye, the pyramid, the burning mountain of fire. That's their symbol. And our leaders predominantly, look, this isn't my opinion. Helmut Schmidt, and this is all in my film, Dark Secrets Inside Bohemian Grove, he was the German chancellor, and he says, we have our own groves in Germany. I love doing rituals there, but I really love the rituals that we do at the Bohemian Grove. So they're calling them rituals. And, you know, I've never said that they're actually sacrificing humans there at the Grove. I've said that others have made that claim. But regardless, they are truly getting off on this. And I'm just glad that John Ronson had the truly original idea and the will to actually go on his fact-finding mission and to include me in it. And I think we've made history. And I also just wanted to add, listening, that this isn't a cakewalk. In my film, Dark Secrets, we have over 10 cases of, you know, People Magazine reporters and Time Warner employees and CBS News reporters, over 10 cases, being arrested, in some cases charged, in the 70s and 80s, trying to get in. And I just think that because we had so much chutzpah or, you know, so much will or so much aplomb in our infiltration, I mean, I was questioned by this. I mean, I talked to locals. This is all in the film. Locals 15, 20 miles away are searched by Secret Service. They set up checkpoints. I mean, the whole area is a police state. We were just able, you know, with the daring dash, and I have to say it was daring dash, and with John's vision, to lightning strike, get in there. Plus, we were peaceful, and I think we had God on our side. God wanted this evil exposed. And when you got the big man upstairs on your side, you know, no group of Pentagon warlocks are going to be able to stop you.
What if someone, Alex, who was in charge, let's say, of security, was fully aware of you folks being there, but wanted you to get in, and maybe figured these are some media guys, they're reporters, they're something, they're not really going to give anybody any danger. We want this exposed. Maybe somebody had an axe to grind, knew you were coming in, and let you guys come through.
George, I'm not just saying this to kiss up to you, even though you've got the second biggest radio show in the country, but you are always so astute. I mean, your question about John saying maybe I was paranoid that he was a government agent, maybe there was a slight microscopic glint or inkling of that, but no, I didn't really think John was an agent. I just thought that four of us trying to sneak in wouldn't work, and so I said, I'm going to go in earlier, and I'm going to try to take the circuitous route in, and that's what I did successfully. But in hindsight, and again, I go off proof. You know, everything I do is proof, but in my gut, which unfortunately is never wrong, or rarely wrong, in my gut, I, talking to Secret Service, talking to Sonoma County Sheriff's deputies who were in there, I really think when they were talking to me, it was like they were smiling at me. I kind of got the feeling that they wanted me to get in and get out with what I got.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know why. But then, on top of that, I wasn't sure. But now Wall Street Journal, San Francisco Chronicle, all these big publications, New York Post admitting that top gay porn stars go in there to, quote, service the moguls. That's the headlines. You know, all of this has now come out. So seeing all that come out later, then I have to think that my instincts, and obviously your instincts, George, are probably going in the right direction. But, John, what do you think of this?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I am constantly amazed that we got in. And you know, thrilled, because if we hadn't got in, then, you know, it would have been like a really bad story.
Especially, John, with the kind of players that were there. I mean, that just doesn't happen.
Well, you guys said millionaires. I mean, we know that dozens of multi-billionaires, people worth $50 billion, admittedly, go to the Grove. And you know, on the other side of things, showing that somebody didn't want us to get the footage, in the hotel rooms that night, they transferred my video that I'd shot over to their camera. They looked at it. They tested it. They mailed it out to England. It was erased. They tried to fly out with video. It was erased. I had to falsely mark the video, mail it to World of Wonder in L.A. They had to falsely label it to get it into England for the editing. John, did that not happen?
Yeah, that's true. And that is one of the great enduring mysteries of my life, I've got to say. We watched the tape get transferred, Alex's tape get transferred into our camera. We watched the whole thing. And I've got no explanation for this at all. When we got back to Los Angeles, we looked at the tape, and Alex going through the parking lot was there. Alex looking around the camp was there. Just before the ritual starts, the tape is erased. There's nothing. And I've got to say, that's always true. I have no explanation for it whatsoever. And so I can't remember what happened after that, Alex. Did you just send us another copy of the tape?
And then it got erased again.
Right. It's.
I believe you're right about that. Yeah. But and listen, this is how paranoid I am, because, I mean, this was a big coup. I wasn't about to lose my prize. You know, this elk that we brought down, basically, is the analogy. I stayed up. You know, we were done with them at about 1 a.m. I stayed up till about 3 a.m. making copies in my room. I went and dropped it in the mailbox with another copy, and then those didn't make it back. So I was fully ready for a SWAT team to hit us and hit us hard and take that footage.
Well, I'm just saying, Alex, I really believe somebody there wanted you guys to get in there, get some information, and get out.
Well, George,
for whatever reason.
I mean, there's no doubt that so much of the evil that the globalists want to bring down on us is held back by good people in their own system. I mean, you know, John and you were talking about earlier about the Bilderberg Group. I mean, these guys openly, I can go off the news that's reported off leaks from the Bilderberg. They're not going to invade Iraq in 02. It's going to be March of 03. Happens. A year and a half before the wall fell that no one could foresee, Jim Tucker says, I snuck into Bilderberg in Germany. You know, the wall's going to fall in this month. It falls in that month. He's done that like 20 times. And literally, I mean, not because he's got a crystal ball, but because they really run things. I mean, they run things. And George, you asked a very astute question. You know, is there a group above these 125 people that go? And Ronson's right. About 100 of them are top globalists, about 25 or 30 are guests who are being vetted and basically squeezed on, you know, like fruit at the grocery store, you know, being tested and meted and selected. But a lot of times the Rothschilds and other globalists, they will send their emissaries to these meetings. And by the way, these international financiers and industrialists, we can track them from funding Hitler and Stalin and Mao. And so their line that they're fighting, you know, a global war, and we need a world government to stop war, they create the crises to then offer their false solution. And that's what we document. I mean, again, in my film, Dark Secrets Inside Bohemian Grove, that I hope people will get, and most of the rituals up for free on Infowars.com, Helmut Schmidt admits, the German chancellor, that they have other groves around the world. This is an international brotherhood of death, and they take it very, very seriously.
And strange, too. Very strange. I mean, I can't remember. You know, when I was in Boy Scouts, we did the typical Boy Scout campfire stuff and scary stories and things like that. You know, as we grow up into men, I can't imagine spending time doing things like this. What are they, I mean, what's the satisfaction here?
Well, it's actually the highest form of black magic. I mean, I've actually read, before I snuck into the Grove, I read several books. Since then, I've read.
So it's not entertainment value here.
Well, I've really studied the occult, and the highest levels of the occult, it's all about, they know that you reap what you sow. They really believe in karma. And they know that they do evil in the world, it's going to come back on them. This is an elaborate 3,000-year-old ritual to displace the bad they do in the marketplace and the bad they do in government. When they burn care, they put all of their bad hoodoo, they put all of their bad actions onto this mock child that they're killing, and that is a sacrifice to appease the powers of darkness, not to feed on them demonically. I mean, it goes back to the Faustian deal, you know, in 1510. It goes back to the Illuminati, 1776. I mean, these are the black magic handbooks. They are following this to the T, to protect themselves. This is all a complex ritualistic amulet to protect themselves. And again, I don't believe in this stuff, but they do. The Pentagon does. It's the same thing over and over again. If you want to understand the geopolitical system, folks, and really know the truth, you've got to realize that world leaders aren't German, they're not Jewish, they're not Chinese, they're not guided by those things. They're guided by Luciferian religion of do as thou wilt and absolute power. And that's what we're facing, and that's what we expose in the film Dark Secrets Inside Bohemian Grove.
I've got a slightly different interpretation.
Go ahead, John.
Okay. Well, what I do believe, I mean, I did a lot of work on Skull and Bones as well, none of which saw the light of day. We tried to sneak into Skull and Bones, but failed. I'm afraid those Yale people failed us. But what I came to believe from speaking to members of Skull and Bones was that, yes, there is all this kind of, you know, you could call it a cultic milieu, and there's no doubt whatsoever that once you're a member of Skull and Bones, you're a member for life. You know, this isn't, you know, for most of these people, this isn't just a kind of college fraternity. This is something they, you know, keep with them for their entire lives. Jonathan Bush, the president's uncle, you know, goes most Thursdays to Skull and Bones and is kind of really into it. But the conclusion I came to is, I suppose, a slightly less, whatever the word is than Alex is. It is basically that the reason for the kind of milieu, you know, this kind of death-like milieu at Skull and Bones and Bohemian Grove, is really that they want to give themselves
an aura.
Yeah, an aura, but for themselves, not for the outside world. It's for themselves. It's like, you are going to rule the world. You know, this is
well,
your
that's the nature of magic. I mean, that's the nature of the secret mystery religions, is these secret schools. Listen, even MSNBC admits that it is the German branch of the Illuminati, founded in 1832 at Yale to overturn our government. And now look at how they're in control. Look at how they're running things. There's a lot of secret members that most people don't even know are Skull and Bones, like Cheney and Clinton and others. There's other chapters. There's a chapter right here in Austin. I've actually been threatened by these people.
By the way, Alex, let me ask you this real quickly, not to divert, but where is Dick Cheney during this Hurricane Katrina situation?
Well, I mean, Bush and, look, Secretary of State Rice was on vacation until Thursday until she was booed out of a theater. I mean, they all saw how horrible this was. She was watching Spin in Manhattan, and she was booed out. And Dick Cheney stays out at Site R, and, I mean, folks, this is insane. I mean, it's just in your face. I mean, I've been working 18 hours a day because of the hurricane. Every other person in the media has been working more hours. Where are the executives? And
do you think his health has failed and they don't want to say anything right now? I thought of that.
Well, he's been in the hospital a whole bunch, and they always claim it's just for tests. I mean, I've heard he's had heart transplants, you name it. I mean, the guy's admittedly had.
I know he hasn't. I don't think he's had a transplant.
Well, I know this. He's had six heart attacks.
Yes.
Six heart attacks, and he disappears for 6 months at a time. And the info I've got from very good sources is, well, I mean, that's a whole other show. All I know is, folks, I don't want to believe this. I don't want to believe this is true. I'm sorry. The facts are the facts. We have a bunch of Luciferians running our government who look at us as cattle, and they laugh at us. They call us, you know, the outsiders or the cattle or the fools or the uninitiated because we can't even admit to ourselves what they're doing right in front of us. Look at the corporate logos. Look at the symbols. Look at all of it, and we expose that at Infowars.com. And, you know, I just thank God that Coast to Coast AM is here, you know, as the vanguard exposing and you know, letting these ideas come out. And, I mean, look at John's book. I mean, it's just right there that the Pentagon gave entree and is still giving entree to this. And look what it bears fruit for. It's involved in Gitmo. It's involved in Camp X-Ray at Waco. Shoemaker, who's now our head military general, he ran Waco playing the white noise and the chants and the dying rabbits.
And we know that they were bringing in these Russian scientists to try and blast the Branch Davidians with subliminal sounds and that kind of stuff.
So,
I mean, there's no doubt about that.
You will know them by their fruits, John. You will know them by their fruits. You look at their fruits. It's all death. It's all evil. It's all pure wickedness, and we must have an awakening. An awakening to this, the fruits of all of this. They all tell you, we're New Age, we're friendly, we're nice, we're Christian conservatives. No, they're not. They can dress this up however they want, but under it, it is a black skeleton of pure evil.
So, I tell you what, I do agree with you, Alex, is that in the post-Vietnam years, when all this stuff burgeoned within military intelligence, they were willing to go wherever it took them. They were willing to go into the worlds of black magic and so on.
And John, they're telling you, and remember, this is the stuff they're admitting. I'm glad you have come out with this, but, I mean, this is what they're willing to admit to you. Folks, it's a lot worse. Then look, I can only talk about what I can prove. Believe me, folks, it is a lot worse than you're even hearing here tonight. I mean, the occult influences in our society, the dark occult influences, are wide-reaching, and I hope people, you know, again, will get the truth, will learn the truth about this new world order.
All right, Alex, thank you. John, stick around for phone calls when we come back. Your phone calls as well. John, do you gather much support when you tell people about some of these things that you've worked on, your theories? Because, you know, I know your television program was well-recepted.
Yeah, I mean, when my first book then came out, I what surprised me when I started doing events was that I'd get people from both sides of the fence in the audience. I'd get kind of believers in Bilderberg and Bohemian Grove, evil power, and I'd get people who were, you know, slightly more kind of distanced and ironic about the whole thing. So people from, you know, the liberal spectrum and people from the further out spectrum all came to the events. And there wasn't any hostility there. I thought that was kind of nice that the book appealed to people on both sides of the fence. And the same has happened with the men who stare at goats, actually, is that I'll get people who believe, like Alex, that it's all connected and that the symbolism proves it and so on. And then I get other people, you know, who think, you know, like I do, that, you know, yes, they journey to the dark side. I mean, there's no question about that. Yes, it's kind of nuts. But no, it isn't evidence of this kind of steely, Machiavellian conspiracy. So again, you know, the book appeals to people on both sides of the fence.
Okay, let's go to the phones. We'll pick it up by going to our international line, first of all. Where are you calling from?
Hello, this is Yanni, calling from Tel Aviv.
Hi, Yanni. How are you?
Very good, thank you, and good morning. I would like to say, if possible, George, and speaking really mostly to John, that John seems to make a good deal of sense because he seems to be dealing with the issue from Bohemian Grove to the dark side to various elements in this matter, he seems to be dealing with it in a balanced way. The only place I think I take issue with a little bit with was with Alex earlier being a little bit over the top as, say, and I'm not necessarily a Clinton fan or not, I think he's an okay guy, but I don't believe in any way that he, maybe other people in the government, I don't know, have, but I don't think people like a Bill Clinton or such are looking down on us as cattle or and doing evil tricks and spinning evil webs so that the masses come under their spell and this kind of thing. That, I think, sells well for somebody like Alex who may believe in this very much and buys into it himself, like many others do. But by comparison, John seems to have a very much more objective view, a more analytical view of everything that he had spoken about from Bohemian Grove, as I said, to Satanism and the dark side and all this. And I just want to tell you that John really stood out as a very fair and honest investigator of the matter.
Okay.
Thanks for your comments. And also, can I add kind of humanist? You know, I don't go in, when I'm dealing with, you know, military intelligence officials who you know, who have journeyed to these places, I don't treat them as demons in the same way that I didn't treat the Klan as demons. I try and treat people as human beings, and I try and both understand and empathize with them on a human level. And human beings are, you know, complicated, fallible, absurd, you know, good people. And I hope that the portrayals of the characters in both them and the Menusteric Goats is that. You know, it's portraying people as human beings.
So you're pretty
side of the fence they're on.
You're convinced, John, that this First Earth Battalion is still in existence and operating, right?
Yeah, I believe that over the decades it twists and turns. And I think some of the people who implement some of the ideas contained in the First Earth Battalion manual probably don't even know, you know, that it comes from this place, this kind of fantastic place. I think the ideas contained within Jim's manual have assimilated their way into the US military in so kind of subtle a way that some of the people in Iraq and Guantanamo who are trying these things out don't even know about its provenance. They don't even know where it came from. For instance, the blasting of Barney the Purple Dinosaur, which I know I keep going back to. I'll tell you what I am a conspiracy theorist about, by the way, is why they chose Barney. The Barney story broke because a Newsweek journalist called Adam Piori was told by a PSYOP soldier called Mark Hadsell, I think, to go over to the shipping containers at the back of this disused railway station in Al-Qaim on the Syrian border. He went back there and he saw that these clerics had been herded into one of these shipping containers and was being blasted with music and a strobe light, like some vicious disco, until a PSYOP soldier told him to go away. And so Newsweek asked him to compile a playlist of songs that were used to blast at prisoners, and one of the songs was Barney the Purple Dinosaur. And I can't help thinking that the reason why they told Adam about Barney was because it sounds funny, you know. And
it
sure
is.
Enough,
it's hilarious.
Well, it is funny, right? But as Kenneth Ross, the head of Human Rights Watch, said to me, you know, they're canny. You know, they're clever people, these PSYOPs guys. You know, if Katie Couric starts making jokes, which she did, you know, about Barney, oh, you know, they'll switch to the Teletubbies next. It kind of makes torture funny. And as I write in the Menusteric Goats, I was sent a photograph of a guy inside one of these shipping containers where Barney was blasted out. This young, you know, he looks about 17, kid. And as I write in the Menusteric Goats, in these photographs, he's screaming so hard it almost looks as if he's laughing. So I think it was a clever PSYOP device to disseminate this funny torture story, because as Eric Olsen, the son of Frank Olsen, who was killed in an MKUltra experiment, said to me once, who wants to replace a story that's fun with a story that's not fun? And until the Abu Ghraib photographs came out, really, Barney was like it had become, you know, the Iraqi torture story, and it was a funny story. And we could all say to ourselves, oh, well, we've had to listen to Barney. It's not that bad. So, you know, so that's one occasion where I think, you know, the wool was pulled over our eyes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with us. Where are you calling from?
Yes, AJ from Los Angeles.
Hi, AJ. Go ahead.
Hi, you have a great show. Yes, I'd like to ask your guest, had he ever heard about a Time, or was it a Newsweek reporter who allegedly asked the president, by the way, the reporter was supposedly a born-again Christian, asked the president if he renounces Satan and did not get an answer. And so the same reporter asked the question again, Mr. President, do you renounce Satan as your Lord and Savior, and would not answer. And I'd like to know if there's any validity to that report.
I've not heard that story.
Nor have I.
Okay.
It could be an internet rumor, but we'll check into it.
Right. I mean, I know that reporters have asked the president about skull and bones.
All the time.
Yeah, and his response is always...
he laughs and doesn't it?
Yeah,
he laughs and he says
I didn't even know it still existed.
East of the Rockies, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George and John.
Hello.
This is Wendy in Indianapolis. And last week, the media reported that Bush cut his California vacation short by 2 days to go to the hurricane site. And I wanted to ask John, do you suppose that Bush had been vacationing at Bohemian Grove?
Gosh, I can't remember what month we went there, because it's always at the same time.
Well, wasn't he at his Crawford Ranch? Wasn't he there?
Mm.
I thought he was there in Texas.
Oh. What I do know is that George Bush Sr. learned of George W. Bush's decision to choose Dick Cheney as his running mate while he was camping in Northern California. So I've always assumed that George Bush Sr. was at Bohemian Grove when me and Alex were there because the timeline fits.
Uh-huh. And, John, what would it take to expose the Grove to the mainstream media?
It's funny, isn't it, that you know, I remember when we got out of the Grove, Alex was saying, you know, this is going to shake up the whole world, you know, this is going to be the biggest news story in the world.
Yeah.
And it kind of wasn't, you know, it was like, I guess, I remember I showed the tape to my father. My dad's, you know, a conservative, you know, regular guy, and I showed the tape of the ritual to him, first person I showed it to, and he kind of watched it silently, and then he said, well, that didn't happen.
Oh,
it was kind of so weird to him that he sort of blanked it out. I think my dad thought that I'd somehow dressed 1,000 men up in robes and faked the whole thing.
It was your own little movie, right?
Yeah. When in fact, my budget doesn't even stretch to, you know, flying premium economy. You know, I could never afford, you know, to fake an entire ritual. So maybe some people just thought it was too far out of their, you know, how they believe the world worked to assimilate it. And then other people maybe figured, like I do to an extent, that it's just silly grown-up fraternity behavior and, you know, it's weird, but it's no more than weird and immature.
I certainly think it's made for prime time.
Yeah, well,
it sure is.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Thank you.
It's all there in my book, Them. So I've just taken a leaf out of Alex's book to constantly mention the name of my product.
How often do you think they meet at Bohemian Grove?
There's the Bohemian Club in San Francisco. My memory is telling me that they meet at the Grove twice a year. But I could be wrong. I mean, certainly, you know, the weekend that we infiltrated was the main summer meeting, which goes on for 2 weeks. And they have their lakeside talks, where they invite, you know, I mean, Oppenheimer apparently gave a big talk, and the Manhattan Project was kind of forged at Bohemian Grove, and John Major went to give a talk, and Kissinger gives a talk. So they have these lakeside talks.
I think Walter Cronkite's been there.
Yeah, I believe so. And a whole lot of movie stars, Clint Eastwood, Danny Glover, people like that. And this ritual that me and Alex watched is like the kind of main Saturday night do. And then they also have these shows where they dress up as women and these have these kind of reviews. And that lasts for 2 weeks. I mean, me and Alex were there for maybe 8 or 9 hours.
You mean these people go there and hang out for 2 weeks?
Yeah, I think some of them probably come and go. So, for instance, I know that John Major, the ex-British Prime Minister, wasn't there for the ritual, but he turned up a couple of days later to give a talk. So he was probably there for, I don't know, a night or two nights or something. But some of them are there for the whole 2 weeks.
First-time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello, calling from Huntington Beach, California.
Okay, take it away.
Hey there. It was due to John's efforts that I first became aware of the Bohemian Grove, and since then I likewise have gone in a couple times.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I can tell you, I doubt they intentionally let you in, because they have tightened up security considerably since you've been there.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I agree with you, actually, I've got to say. I know that you know, you, George, and Alex were saying, you know, maybe they let us in, but you know, my guess or my thought at the time was that it was just luck that we got in.
Now, when you go through that guard shack that you wave at, they actually make you get out of the bus, walk through that guard shack, show your ID, and come out the other side and get back on the bus.
So how come you got in?
I really don't want to say, but I got in a couple times, and it may happen again, so I got to keep it quiet on that.
Do you agree with the way that I interpreted the events, having witnessed it yourself?
Overall, largely I do. I do think there's an occultic flavor to it, certainly a pagan flavor with the Princess Diana statue and, you know, praying to the god of nature for salvation, the effigy. I guess to the cremation of care. In fact, I took several pictures. I just fired off an email to George Norrie there, which I actually got a picture of the effigy and et cetera inside the owl.
All right, I'd like to look at that.
Yeah, but I think what happens, from what I've heard from Kathy O'Brien, are you familiar with her? Yeah, she says she's been to the Grove, she claims, and she says most of the really occultic stuff happens behind the scenes. It's a 2,500-acre, you know, area. Mm-hmm. And only about 150 acre is this frat, you know, made up of 119 camps currently. And supposedly a lot of it behind the scenes is where the occultic stuff goes, and the front area is really just a party where they, you know, get drunk and run around naked and do funny things.
Right.
But certainly not satanic throughout the main area, is the impression I got being in there several times.
Right. And I don't want to impugn the integrity of Kathy O'Brien, who I don't know and haven't met, but when I read her book, The Transformation of America, the geography, when, you know, now that I've been inside the Grove, the geography she describes inside the Grove is different to the geography that I saw. And it made me suspect that there's a possibility that she hadn't been in there. But without having the book in front of me, I can't tell you exactly what it is that...
No, and I agree with you on that part. It's hard to tell whether she's legit or not. I'm not for sure, but it kind of makes sense. If there is something that goes on there, it is behind the scenes. It's not that all 3,000 members are active Satanists.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. So, you know, what we saw was, as I say, was nuts, and it was intense, and it was not how I would want to spend my summer vacation, but it was sort of just about explicable.
Could you assume, John, that then some of the people there have no idea what's really going on?
Well, I can only say what I saw, and what I saw was you know, what I describe in them, you know, this you know, strange ritual with all these men really into it. I mean, whether I, you know, I can't speculate as to whether stuff was going on that I didn't see, because I didn't see it. You know, them, like the Menesteric Goats, is a first-person narrative where I really write about, you know, what I have personally experienced and witnessed. And, you know, my 8 or 9 hours inside Bohemian Grove is the beginning and end of what I know about Bohemian Grove.
Would you like to go back?
Probably not. You know, I think they'd be kind of pissed with me. I mean, it was an amazing, memorable, you know, experience that I'll take with me to my deathbed. But I sort of figured once is enough. I'm glad I got out without being thrown into jail.
Well, and with your head.
Yeah, and yeah, not in the fiery belly of the giant owl.
I mean, they could have taken a shot at you.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, terrible. And I'm not a fearless person. You know, Alex is a fearless person. I'm not. The only reason why I went into Bohemian Grove was because, you know, that's where the story took me. And once the story takes you somewhere, you just have to do it as much as you personally don't want to. But, you know, I was basically terrified trying to get into the Grove.
Once I was in there,
I felt quite safe because I was with this guy, Rick, a lawyer, who looked like a kind of preppy guy in his 50s.
And he fits right in there.
Yeah, exactly. And I was with Rick, so I kind of knew instinctively that I was safe once I was in there because I was with Rick. But, you know, but I don't really enjoy those dangerous adventures, I've got to tell you.
What does your gut tell you about why they go there and what's going on?
Well, as I sort of said earlier when Alex was on, a couple of people in Skull and Bones said to me that the whole reason for this kind of milieu, this spooky milieu, is to kind of give themselves a mandate to rule the world. It's as if, you know, if they surround themselves in this iconography, it's like, okay, you know, we are special, we are important, you know, we rule the world. And part of me thinks that's also what Bohemian Grove is about. It's to sort of boost in them this kind of sense of superiority.
All right, stay with us, John. We'll be back. We'll take final phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. John, do you believe in some conspiracy theories, most conspiracy theories, or hardly at all?
Some conspiracy theories. You only have to look at the way that the war in Iraq began, with Blair and Bush conspiring, you know, away from their elected bodies to begin this war. You know, and it doesn't surprise me at all that there's been such a renaissance of conspiracy theories since 9/11, because you get renaissances of conspiracy theories when you get our leaders behaving in conspiratorial manners. So I do believe that. I suppose where I take issue is the kind of meta conspiracy theories where you link absolutely everything together and you connect absolutely everything. You know, I basically don't believe that. I think you should take each fact as it comes.
Because there are some who believe that everything's a conspiracy. Everything.
Yeah, and I don't buy that. It's kind of, you know, when you take something like Bohemian Grove and you put Henry Kissinger plus robes plus hoods plus giant owl, you know, it's kind of no wonder you've got a conspiracy theory. And it's the same with the stuff I read about in the Menesteric Goats. You know, when you've got military intelligence officers journeying off into the dark side, into the world of magic, both white and black magic, to bring back ideas into the military about ways of fighting future war. Again, it's no wonder, and that manifests itself in soldiers trying to kill goats just by staring at them. It's kind of no wonder you get conspiracy theories. But I look at these people and I see human beings trying to do what they think is right at the time. You know, I see the sort of fallibility of humanity as opposed to, you know, conspiracy theories imply that these people are somehow better than us, they're greater than us, they're cleverer than us, they are more Machiavellian than us. And I think at times there is obvious truth to that, and you only have to look at the way that the Bush administration and the Blair administration often act to show that they do like to make deals behind closed doors. But I think we give them too much credit when we say that they're, you know, brilliantly conspiring in every single conceivable way to keep us down.
Okay, thanks for that response. Wildcard Line, you're on the air. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Hi, my name is Simon, and I did run into the Illuminati.
How so, Simon?
First of all, I want to just say I'm praying for Alex Jones. He hit it right on the head, and that this all started on Good Friday. Forgive me, I'm kind of nervous right now. But
I'm going to have to get you to tell me why you saw or dealt with the Illuminati.
They said they were going to play with my mind. And all of a sudden, I seen all these signs. The Wicca, you heard about the Wiccans, the witches, it's all real. The black magic.
No, don't get confused now. People who practice Wicca are generally,
George,
I've met, they're all good people.
Well, I'm trying to explain what happened. It's real. It's the spiritual realm. And everywhere I went, I seen symbols, all these pentagrams. Everything. I was scared for my life. I was really scared, and all I could do, well, I was led to the rosary and to the message of Fatima, and believe me, it's very real. The Illuminati is real. What is happening with the New Orleans? is everything is. It's. Have you read the book, The Illuminati, by Larry Burkett?
Oh yeah, of course.
Well, it has parallels of what's happening right now with New Orleans and everything.
It's happening everywhere.
Yeah, yes, I started reading about it after I had that run-in because of all the strange things that was happening. And I was met by a couple of strange people that told me I was taken to the next level. And it is true, this with God and everything. The Pope was a huge player. He was born on an eclipse and he died on an eclipse. And the message of Fatima has so much to do with what's happening right now with the rosary and the Blessed Virgin. I was being attacked psychically.
All right, now let me say this, though, with regards to the Wiccans. I think what you're confused over is those who are in the Illuminati are more Satanists, quite frankly, than those who practice the Wiccan religion, where they believe in a male-female god. But everyone I have met, they love people, they love animals, they're wonderful people. I've not met one person from that religion that was a bad person. I don't know about you, John. Have you had that exposure?
Yeah, and I agree with you. I always worry slightly as well about saying that Bohemian Grove is paganistic because, a lot of pagans I know are very nice people too.
Yeah, there's a big difference between someone who worships Satan, mm-hmm. performs the Black Mass, than people who have these other kinds of religions.
Yeah, I agree. It's people who love the earth, they love the planet, they want to live their lives in this. And, you've got to be careful. I mean, when you demonize people who hold strange religions, suddenly what you've got is the FBI surrounding David Koresh's church, and you've got the FBI surrounding Randy Weaver's home. So, I agree. I think you've got to be careful.
Do you stay in touch with Randy Weaver?
I've not spoken to Randy in a while. I was really fond of Randy and his daughter, Rachel. Rachel, I'd say, is kind of one of the most incredible people I've ever met, in fact. She was so wise beyond her years. And what happened to the family was so awful. But I've not spoken to them in quite a long while, unfortunately. I'd have to keep in touch. Especially.
Has he forgiven, or is it still...
He's forgiven, but he's also... No, I wouldn't say he's... No, he hasn't forgiven. But what he has done is begun to believe, rightly or wrongly, that it was partly his fault, for harming the kids.
For the confrontation, maybe?
Yeah, the comfort for being so pig-headed, and for giving guns to the kids. I mean, what you had, inside Randy's cabin was this kind of spiral of paranoia. And what you had outside of the cabin was a spiral of paranoia.
I mean, if I remember, didn't the kids grab guns and they were shooting back at the government law enforcement?
What happened was that some marshals got too close to the cabin. They were staking out Randy's cabin on a completely ludicrous, trumped-up bit of nonsense.
Right.
Which was nothing. And they staked out Randy's cabin. One of them got too close to the dog. The dog started chasing them down the hill. Sammy Weaver and a friend of theirs, Kevin Harris, I think his name was, chased the dog down the hill. A marshal jumped out from the bushes and shot the dog. Sammy said, "You shot my dog, you son of a bitch," and started firing into the air, firing wildly. One of the soldiers then shot Sammy, who was, I think, 12 years old, in the arm, I think. And then Sammy started running back to the cabin saying, "Dad, I'm coming home, Dad." And then the marshal shot Sammy in the back and killed him. And then Kevin Harris opened fire. Actually, this has never been proven. A marshal was killed in the gunfire.
Right.
And nobody, I think, has proven whether he was killed by friendly fire or whether he was killed by Kevin Harris or indeed Sammy Weaver. I believe definitely not Sammy Weaver, but that's inconclusive. And then, of course, all hell
broke. They just assumed that the kids killed him.
Yeah, or it's certainly in the kind of propaganda that happened after that shooting. You know, it was all the Weavers' fault. You know, the Weavers were the greatest enemy that America faced. You know, the FBI came in. You know, the Weavers were white supremacists when there is really no evidence to suggest that they were supremacists. Terrible, absolutely terrible. Ruby Ridge is one of those places where conspiracy theories come true.
All right, let's go back to West of the Rockies. You're on the air. Hi there.
Yes, George, Abraham in Eureka, California.
Hello,
very quickly.
Sure.
I'm hearing people say that they attended these meetings and in turn coming with no names and very vague information. A lot of this information is information that I can make up. And to your guests, you say it's a conspiracy and everything is a conspiracy, but I believe you are a pawn in a greater conspiracy and your theories are simply misdirection. Thank you very much. I will listen to your response off the air.
Well, are you a pawn, John?
I'm not a knowing pawn. And the meetings I say I attended, you know, or got chased away from, I did attend and I did get chased away from. And, you know, the great thing about making documentary series to go along with books is that, you know, I film everything. So, you know, if anybody doubts me, they just have to look at the Russias and they can see me there. Now, whether or not I'm a pawn, I mean, people have said, you know, well, it was mentioned earlier in the show that maybe I was allowed into Bohemian Grove, you know, because they knew I was kind of, you know, tolerant and would report it in a sort of non, you know, crazy way. I mean, I kind of doubt that. But I'll tell you what I do think, you know, is that I'm known in the United Kingdom, especially to be a sort of moderate journalist. I work for a mainstream newspaper called The Guardian. You know, I think people will talk to me more than they would talk to other journalists because they see me as possibly less of a threat. Sometimes that proves to be right. Sometimes that proves to be wrong. Sometimes I understand what they're telling me. Sometimes I, you know, write things that annoys them. But I think I'm probably, you know, I think they see me possibly as being one of them. Which is
why did Alex think that initially?
About me?
Yeah.
I guess because he didn't know me that well, you know. Maybe he'd seen the movie The Wicker Man and, you know, sort of saw himself as Edward Woodward being forced into this, you know, giant effigy. I don't know, you know, I'm a sort of, you know, English liberal guy who doesn't have an axe to grind. Maybe it was just the heat of the moment that made Alex think that.
Or maybe you are, John.
Or maybe I am. Although I'm not absolutely sure that they'd have me.
Next up, Wildcard Line. You're on Coast to Coast. Where are you calling from?
Hi, George. This is Eric in Minneapolis.
Yeah, hello, Eric. Go ahead.
Hi. I think I might have actually been the first person to tell you about the men who stare at goats and John Ronson and everything a couple months ago.
I do believe you were the first person.
Well, awesome. Thank you for spreading the word.
Yeah, it was a great book. I really enjoyed it. I mean, the way you took, you know, I mean, it's kind of an over-the-top subject to begin with, but you handled it beautifully, I have to say.
That's great.
A couple quick questions, and I'll just listen off the air, okay? I was wondering if you have any insight maybe on the technological side of the Black Ops thing, or if maybe you have some clue as to their, like, overall agenda. And then as far as the occult stuff goes, do you think the people involved, do they actually believe it, or do you think it's more of just a means to an end type of thing, like trying to get everything into power or like weaponize everything type of thing? And then also, Guy Saville, did you ever have any more information about him or more contact with him after he disappeared at the end of the book, or, you know, anybody like him, anything like that? And I'll just listen off the air. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric.
Okay. Well, Guy, it's Guy Saville. I was going to do a radio show with Guy, and they had him on the air, and just as they went to him, his phone went dead, and I got really kind of nervous.
Well, that's happened to some of our guests, too. Just when they're into something controversial,
yeah.
Poof, they're gone.
Well, Guy told me afterwards that he was driving, and he dropped the phone, and it broke. I don't know. But the technological side of it, that's something we've not spoken about too much in the last 3 hours, and it's so interesting. One of Jim Channon's ideas in the 1st Earth Battalion was that military scientists should journey to the furthest corner of their imaginations to try stuff out. And a whole gamut of non-lethal weapons were really inspired by this idea, especially via Colonel John Alexander, who was, you know, a good friend of Jim's.
Oh, yes, good man.
Yeah, was inspired by all of this stuff. And he, you know, opened up a whole world of non-lethals from the sticky foam through to the taser gun. I mean, he didn't invent these things, as you know, but what he did was nurture and support them. I know the taser gun's extremely controversial, but I also assume that lives have been saved because of the taser gun.
Mm-hmm. True.
And likewise. And, you know, what certainly seems to be very much alive today in Iraq and in Cuba is the idea of sound weaponry. We know at Waco that they were going to blast David Koresh with these subliminal sounds. The story is that they were going to get Charlton Heston to play the voice of God to tell David Koresh to surrender. And they flew in the scientist called Igor Smirnov, and they were going to lace some of the noises they were blasting at the church, you know, with these silent sounds. And the only reason why that didn't happen was because the Americans wanted Igor Smirnov to take responsibility if anything went wrong. And he, you know, wisely said, nope. And so apparently they never tried to blast it. But, you know, when you hear these stories going on in Cuba, like Jamal Al-Harith, a Guantanamo detainee who was released because he was presumably innocent, and I met him and he said they were blasting him, you know, with Fleetwood Mac and Chris Christopherson, you wonder whether they were lacing those things with these silent sounds, either high or low frequency sounds.
He's lucky we didn't use old Tiny Tim songs.
Right, exactly. He was spared Barney as well.
Through the tulips.
Yeah. So I imagine, given the evidence that I have uncovered in the Ministeriet Goats, that these sound technologies, you know, are certainly being looked at today in the various different, you know, detainee camps. I think, and this goes on to another of the questions just now, is that the way to look at Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib and the other camps is the same way that you should look at Waco, which is basically that they're like experimental labs. You know, it's very rare that the U.S. military have a bunch of people at their disposal. It doesn't happen that often. And what seems to happen is that you get this kind of casserole of ideas. Let's try this. Let's try that. Do you remember that guy, Jim Channon, the 1st Earth Battalion? He said, maybe we should try this. And it's like, I said to Jamal, you know, how did you feel at Guantanamo Bay? And he said, I felt like a guinea pig. It's like a golden opportunity to try stuff out on people.
And then see what happens. Final call, east of the Rockies. You're up with us. Hi.
Hello.
Yes, sir. I've only got about a minute, but it's all yours.
This is Mike from Virginia, and I'd like to ask John about kind of an unusual comment that Alex made.
Okay.
Alex mentioned that there were top gay porn stars there to service the participants at Bohemian Ridge or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Grove, yeah.
Grove. And I wondered why supposedly straight, conservative Christian males would consort with gay male porn stars.
All right. Do you know anything about that, John? That's what Alex said.
Well, there's been a lot of rumors for a lot of years that prostitutes are flown into the Grove. Now, whether they're male or female prostitutes, I really don't know. But apparently, you know, hookers from all over the place, you know, turn up at
indeed.
Yeah, into the vicinity.
A strange, strange place. John Ronson, thank you so much. Good luck with this latest book.
Thank you.
The Men Who Stare at Goats. Okay, appreciate you being on the program.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
Okay, my pleasure. That's John Ronson, live in London. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasur, Ian Punnett, Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, please be safe, everyone.